Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamarick. Joining me today is Professor Eliseo Cheo Torres. He's the current Vice President for Student Affairs at UNM, as well as a professor for Department of Language, Literacy, and Sociocultural Studies. Professor Torres has focused much of his career on ensuring the success of Hispanic students, first in South Texas, where he's from, and over his 21 years at the University of New Mexico. He was recently inducted into the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities Hall of Champions. Welcome, Professor Torres.
Well, thank you, Megan.
So you grew up in South Texas. How did that influence your decision to go into academia?
I started my career in the 1970s, early 70s, in Teacher Corps.
And what was Teacher Corps? What was that designed to do?
Teacher Corps was like Teach for America, but it was like, and also like Peace Corps. And we had a two-year commitment to work in impoverished schools. And I was sent to the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, where there's a very large concentration of migrants and Hispanics. And I was working under Texas A&I University, all of us. And soon after my stay with Teacher Corps, I applied for a job with the Texas Education Agency that oversees all of the public universities in Texas and some universities, public schools and universities. About two or three years after being with the State Department of Education, I was asked to join the faculty at Texas A&I University as a professor. And I did, which gave me the opportunity to get my doctor's degree and to experience teaching and administration. And that got me started in higher education, and I loved it. I was one of the first vice presidents of that school in the 1970s because student affairs is a fairly new field. And here I am, some 30 years so later.
What did you see were the needs of Hispanic students when you were starting out?
Well, I saw the needs as opportunities. I saw that they needed motivation to pursue higher education. And many of them thought they couldn't afford it, but they didn't know too much about student financial aid. They needed counseling. It was first-generation students. It's just motivating them, being a mentor to these students and encouraging the bright students, and sometimes just taking the right courses and preparation courses in high school to prepare them for matriculation into higher education. I think those needs are still pretty evident. These students are bright. They can do anything they want to do. It's just a matter of, once a student, minority student goes to college, then most likely their sons and daughters will continue. And that generation is going to improve themselves, and they're going to understand what going to college is all about. We have a lot of first-generation students on the UNM campus, as well as the campuses in South Texas. But tell you what, once they get their degree, it's going to change their lives, and the movement goes on for future generations.
I know you were a member of the group that first came up with the concept of HACU, the Hispanic mm-hmm. Association of Colleges and Universities. That was in 1985. Mm-hmm. Why did you think it was necessary to have this organization focused on that mission and needs?
Well, at that time, Texas had another association called TACUSPA, the Texas Association of Chicanos in Higher Education. And we wanted to go beyond TACUSPA. We decided that HACU would serve the Southwest mostly, not realizing that it was going to grow so much and it was going to be an association of more than 400 universities. It was going to attract universities from Central and South America, Spain. And really, we had no idea that it was going to get this large and it was going to be so effective. But the program has just grown by leaps and bounds, and it's well-respected, and it's brought a lot of funds to universities that serve Hispanic students.
What do you think the main issues are now, today, for Hispanic students, for the universities serving them?
I think the main issues are basically the same issues that were around in the mid-1980s is recruitment, retention, and graduation of Hispanics. And financial support. Haku also has an internship program, and most of the interns go to Washington, D.C. for a summer or a semester. And that has been wonderful. They've probably have served approximately 10,000 Hispanic students in internships program because they go back to that agency, and for example, the State Department, and they start working for government or for major companies throughout the country. So Haku has really done an excellent job, a well-respected organization from the federal agencies as well as from businesses from throughout the country.
You have spoken out in support of students called Dreamers, those here under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. How are Hispanic-serving universities like UNM addressing that issue?
My gut feeling is that we're probably doing more than most universities. The state has been very good to Dreamers. We don't consider them international students. They do receive the lottery scholarship. I raise money every year to support them with scholarships through the Mexican consulate here in Albuquerque and also through a business called Mesquite Stores. We do a golf tournament, and we raise about $50,000 every year. The Mexican consul matches that. So sometimes we'll have $100,000 to support them with not huge scholarships, but $1,000 from El Mesquite, $1,000 from the Mexican consul, because they don't qualify for student financial aid. A lot of our Dreamers now are getting degrees in professional fields like medicine, law, pharmacy, nursing. I'm just hoping that soon our Congress can come up with the adequate policies and regulations to support them and to help them become citizens, residents and then citizens, because this is what we want to keep Dreamers in this country.
Is it risky for the institution to go up against federal policy or even?
Well, we're not going against. We want the federal policy to change to support them. Mm-hmm. And I think that right now there is an intention. Politicians will say, yes, we want to support this. We want to keep the students, but we just have to make it happen. Sometimes the wheels move slowly in politics, but this country usually does the right thing, and I'm sure that we'll do the right thing to support these wonderful students.
There was talk earlier this year of creating like sanctuary campuses.
Mm-hmm. We're not calling it sanctuary campuses, but we really have all the benefits that to support the Dreamers at UNM. It's a dreamer-friendly campus, like a lot of campuses throughout the country.
But what would happen if they decided at the federal level to really enforce these immigration laws and sent immigration agents?
I hope it doesn't happen.
Okay.
I don't believe this country would do such a thing. How could you send these kids? Because they came here as babies, and they know no other country except this country. And to send them back to a country they don't know, it's not right. So I don't believe this country would make that decision.
What do you think that UNM is doing well in terms of minority recruitment and serving students from diverse groups, and what could it do better?
Well, the university, as far as I know, for the last 20 years, I've been here 21 years, has always done the right thing, created programs to support these students. The College Enrichment Program is one that serves first-generation students. The Ron McNair Program offers research opportunities for these students at their junior level and encourage them to get their master's and doctor's degree. This university has done a wonderful job with minority students and also encouraging them to go into the professional fields, into medicine, into law, into pharmacy. What can it do better, I think, is just doing what we're doing and encouraging these students to also consider higher education as a profession. I would love to see more minorities in higher education. And we're seeing some of them, but I'd like to see more doing research, top research, and also teaching it and being role models in higher education. That's what I hope that we can continue doing and do a better job of encouraging them to consider higher education as a career.
If you're just joining us here on KUNM, this is University Showcase, and I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with Dr. Eliseo Cheo Torres. He's the Vice President for Student Affairs at the University of New Mexico. He also serves as a professor for the Department of Language, Literacy, and Sociocultural Studies. Professor Torres was recently inducted into the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities Hall of Champions. He also has a passion for and teaches a class on curanderismo, or traditional folk healing from the Southwest and Mexico.
My mentor, a professor by the name of Stanley Bittinger, introduced me to curanderismo. We went to a festival of curanderos in a small village called Espinazo, right next to the big city of Monterrey, Mexico. And I fell in love with the topic. I met a wonderful healer by the name of Chenchito, who was 60 years at the time I met him. That was like 30 years ago. And now he's in his 90s. And he became my mentor and my teacher. And I learned the things that my mother used to do, rituals and herbs, from medicinal herbs. But my mom could not tell me why she did the things that she did. But Chenchito could. I became his assistant, and I followed him around, and I started writing in the 1980s. I wrote a couple of short books, one called The Green Medicine and the other one, The Folk Healer. I self-published these books because publishers weren't interested in this topic. Well, I came to New Mexico in 1996, and I combined both of these two little books into a book called Healing with Herbs and Rituals, and I included some of the wonderful plants of New Mexico, like Osha, Hierba de la Negrita, and several other wonderful plants that are typical of New Mexico. And then people started asking me, why don't you write about your stories? I have a lot of stories, a lot of experiences with wonderful healers, mostly from Mexico, but also from other parts of Latin America and South America. So I wrote another book, the fourth book, called Curandero, Alive in Mexican Folk Healing, where I tell my stories. And then I started teaching a class 17 years ago, a two-week summer class that became very popular. Started with 30 students the first year, and all of a sudden it started growing. Now I've got more than 200 students that for 2 weeks, and students are coming from different parts of the country. And then this year I wrote a textbook, and this textbook is called Curandero, The Art of Traditional Medicine Without Borders. And a second book that complements that book is a book of photographs of the wonderful curanderos I work with, called Curandero, Traditional Healers of Mexico and the Southwest. So,
what prompted your passion about curanderismo?
I believe my mom did. My mom, we lived in a country away from doctors and hospitals. So my mom used to tell us, there were eight of us in the family, don't you dare get sick, and if you do, I'll be your doctor. And she was. She took care of our illnesses with herbs, with rituals, and we hardly ever saw a doctor.
I know there's been a growing interest over the years in your class and in curanderismo. People come from all over to attend your workshop. Why do you think it's growing so much?
Because very few people are doing this, and people are hungry to find out more about traditional medicine. And I'm getting a large group, believe it or not, from Minnesota, the Health Science Center there. A few physicians come. I'm getting a group from Long Island, New York. I get a group from California, from Texas, from Arizona. Very few people are doing this. And I'm bringing some really top healers. I'm tied to a school in Mexico, in Cuernavaca, Mexico, that teaches traditional medicine for the last 30 years or so they've been doing this. So I bring some top healers that do research and know what they're doing.
I know not everything in folk medicine is effective. How do you decide which traditions work and are the ones you should teach?
You know, even if it's not proven that it's effective, if it's a placebo effect, it's still good. If people think they're going to get better, they do get better. And we are very selective on what we teach in the class. And who presents in the class. There are charlatans out there in the public that really are out to take people's money, and we know how to identify these folks. So we're very selective in the books that I've written. There's research done in all these topics.
What's the goal with your books and the course in terms of integrating it with mainstream and Western?
Well, my goal at first was just to inform students that grow up with this topic but know very little. It's just information. But as I've taught the class, a lot of allopathic physicians have been interested, and nurses and others. So my goal is to try to integrate as much as possible traditional and allopathic modern medicine to be able to meet the needs of the people. People know what they want. I mean, Chinese medicine has been able to do this very effectively over thousands of years. They've combined both traditional and modern medicine, and I think we can do that with curanderismo. Combine both of them so that the people can choose. And also, it doesn't cost much to do this for some illnesses. It's a matter of knowing yourself, knowing your body, knowing what's effective and what's not, and knowing when to see a physician. That's very important.
Yeah, when you actually do need to go see a
Western doctor. Yes, you may need an operation, and curanderismo is not going to help much with that. Or you've got an infection that herbs are not as powerful as antibiotics.
Have you found any of the doctors here at the medical school or the health sciences center interested in what you're doing?
Definitely. Not only at our health science center, but also in places like Minnesota Health Science Center, even the health science center at University of Colorado. So there's a lot of universities that are interested and they want to know more about it.
What about you? What have you used curanderismo throughout your life to heal ailments you had?
Definitely. I grew up with this. And in the book, Curandero, A Life in Mexican Folk Medicine, I tell a lot of stories about how effective this is and my personal experiences with my family and also with others like Chinchito, another curandero, Doña María, a wonderful healer. Bless Me Ultima, the book by Anaya, kind of indicates some of the things that were happening back during that time. I'm guessing it happened in the 30s or so. Curanderismo has just maintained many of these things, but now we're doing some research and people are researching these plants and some of the rituals and how effective they can be. I can tell you pretty much most of the rituals, the theories behind the ritual and why it's effective. I mean, laugh therapy, that's part of one of the modules. It's on laugh therapy. Well, in modern medicine, that's been happening. Dr. Patch Adams, a physician, goes around making kids laugh, knowing that that's part of the healing process. But curanderos have been doing that for years.
You had sciatica.
Sciatica, of course. I had sciatica for years, and I had a flare-up in Mexico, in Cuernavaca at this school, and Rita Navarrete, who is a wonderful healer who comes to this class annually, worked on my body, and she pulled and she massaged, and she worked on it for a couple of hours. The next day, it hurt a little bit, but I was walking much better. The third day, I was running. Since then, I haven't had a flare-up with sciatica.
Wow, that's amazing.
They can manipulate. She used ventosas on my body. Ventosas is cupping. Chinese cupping. During the Olympics, Michael Phelps had it. You remember those bruises you saw on his back? Well, he had cupping, but it was Chinese cupping. Mexican cupping is a little bit different. They call it fire cupping, running cupping, different from Chinese cupping. And she did cupping on me. And I tell you what, whatever she did worked because I feel wonderful.
Well, Dr. Eliseo Torres, Cheo Torres, thank you so much.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you for your questions and for your support and for your program.
That was Eliseo Cheo Torres. He's vice president for student affairs and was recently inducted into the Hispanic Association of Colleges and Universities Hall of Champions. And if you just tuned in, this is University Showcase on KUNM. Now we turn to an interview on activism and art from KUNM's Spencer Beckwith.
Shubhankar Banerjee is an internationally known writer, environmental activist, and scholar. He is also an extraordinary photographer. Several of his large-scale photographs of Arctic Alaska are now on view at the UNM Art Museum. Professor Banerjee chairs the university's Land Art of the American West program, and he is with us now. Shubhankar Banerjee, welcome.
Thank you, Spencer, for having me.
Many people's assumptions about the Arctic, its supposed emptiness, are going to be challenged by these photographs. Was that one of your intentions?
That was, because politically, the pro-oil development politicians have described the place as flat, white nothingness, frozen wasteland of snow and ice, similar to how our desert right here in New Mexico in the Southwest often been described as a wasteland. So I thought art could be a wonderful visual language to challenge these perceptions. And I selected a motif very early on, which was color. So color for me is not a medium, but a motif through which various ecological relations can be highlighted. So that's what we are doing in the exhibit.
And one of the ways of looking at these photographs is the beauty of what I might call a monochromatic palette.
That's precisely right. So I started thinking very hard, how can I make a photograph with just one color, with two colors, with three colors? So you see white only, white and brown, white and blue, and so on and so forth. So it's built through that idea in mind, that the spare aesthetic, spare but still ecologically incredibly rich, both its biodiversity and cultural richness of the indigenous people.
These are large-scale photographs. Why large?
In this exhibit, you will see works that are very large. And then right juxtaposed to that, you will see small photographs of harvest, only 18 inches wide or something like that. It's not that one thing is large, the other thing is small, but how you bring scale together to create tension. Just the viewing distance, one will push you away to see it properly. One will bring you closer. There are political tensions going on. There are environmental history tensions. There are environmental justice issues. So all those things go on in such presentation of scales.
One of the important things that I didn't see until I saw the large-scale version of your photographs were caribou tracks. And there is one particularly striking photograph that is simply of caribou tracks on a coal seam. What might that photograph be telling us?
These caribou have walked over coal bed or coal seams that are visible on the surface for, who knows, hundreds, thousands of years, many millennia. It is the largest caribou herd in Alaska and one of the largest in North America. But right underneath their calving ground lies the largest coal deposit of North America, an estimated 4 trillion ton of bituminous coal that could potentially supply U.S. coal need for 4,000 years. But if we burn all that coal, of course, life on Earth would be dead long before then. But so what image like that is doing is juxtaposing political ecology on top of geology and encouraging us to see landscape in a different way, that it's not all for exploitation of fossil fuels resources, but thinking about the biological richness, thinking about the cultural communities. There are actually three different tribes from 40 communities depend on that caribou herd for their cultural, nutritional, and spiritual sustenance.
What is the connection between making art and making a statement?
Art, I feel, has a strong role to play in helping us change direction, in helping us to understand, apprehend, and then take action. So my art has evolved in that political space because the area where I first worked was Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, one of the most biologically diverse places in the entire Arctic. It's in Alaska, and two indigenous communities, the Gwich'in and the Inupiat, depend on the biodiversity of that place. And yet, it is also the most politically debated place in the American history, public land-wise, because there is oil underneath that biological diverse place. So art for me and activism for me got enmeshed very early in my work, and they continue to be that way.
It's obvious when one walks through this exhibit, there are two things going on, an artistic side and there is an activist side. Are those two sides compatible?
It's not about compatibility. It's not about creating harmony. It's about creating tension. And when we create tension, that's when I think art succeeds the best. And what art and humanities enables us to do is hold these contradictions in place and engage with it.
You have said that the text is not there simply as a description of the photographs, but as part of the art itself. What do you mean by that?
What I'm encouraging the visitors to do is not think about an art museum exhibit in a linear manner, meaning you start at the beginning and you go through the whole thing and you end at the end. What I'm encouraging is a networked experience, meaning you will come across a visual object or a text, even a word, even a term, and then you'll encounter it a little bit later in the exhibit. Then you'll encounter it again and possibly again. And that's what ecology is about. It's a science of connection at its most basic. So this exhibit enables us to create such science of connections. And the reason we did that is the Art Museum Director Arif Khan and I, one of our top priorities was to engage and encourage all departments of the university to engage with this exhibit, public all across New Mexico to engage with this exhibit, that they'll find something that they care about, whether it's environmental history, whether it's environmental law, whether it's public policy, American studies, Native American studies, biology, what have you.
You have said that growing up, one of the influences on you was filmmaking, and there are a lot of great Bengali filmmakers, for instance, Satyajit Ray. Could you talk a little bit about what his influence as a filmmaker was on you as an artist and as an activist?
I'm so glad you brought up Satyajit Ray. He's, of course, one of our greats. But it's not Ray. It's actually three of them. They were all contemporaries. Hrithik Ghatak is probably my most favorite filmmaker of all time. They were contemporaries. And Mrinal Sen. They all used their art to address social issues in many different ways. Ray was more subtle. Mrinal Sen was very direct. Ghatak was somewhere in between. That's what I grew up with because we had no money to really engage with so-called visual art like painting in a museum and things like that. We could spend very little money and go into a cinema and actually watch these what we used to call art films. And that had great influence on me to think about kind of the visual art as a means to address social and environmental issues. My entire goal now is to work with our students across campus. Actually, this last spring, I just taught a class called Integrative Ecology and Social Transformation. I had 40 students from 15 different departments, and they amazed me how collaborative they are. In that class, we did so many wonderful things. Again, my priority is not just art students, though. It's bringing the university community together because the crises we are dealing with are of such enormous proportion that art, humanities, science, everybody has a role to play, and the community. So my students engage very closely with our community via the Oro National Wildlife Refuge, Los Jardines Institute. So my priority is also right here in Albuquerque, even as we talk about the Arctic and India and other places.
Photographs of Arctic Alaska by UNM Professor Shubhankar Banerjee are on view at the UNM Art Museum in Albuquerque.
Thanks to Spencer for that story. And thanks to my guest, Eliseo Cheo Torres. You can hear these interviews again and find our past programs at kunm.org. This is Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.